ça. Ça suffit. Morning, members de la maquette. Can I check whether the resource center is here? Are they here? I will not do the summary as indicated in the program. It was well done yesterday by my co-chair. We will first let me welcome all members and all our guests that are present today. You are most welcome in this committee and in this parliament. We look forward to your submissions and also promise that indeed something will be done about them. So I'm just saying this so that when you present with hope, you know, don't have that negativity to say, what is going to be done after all? We promise we are going to do something about them. If we don't, you have the right to hold us accountable for that. Can we then start the Legal Resource Center? And there's two, it's Legal Resource Center and POW. Can we understand whether you are representing the Resource Center or POW?
Chairperson, I'm representing both.
Both, yes. Oh, that's fine. We may begin.
Thank you,
Chairperson. And how are you presenting?
I just have notes. I have notes. I don't have a PowerPoint.
That's fine.
Will that be okay?
That's fine. Members, please note and take your concerns and you jot down your questions.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning to the members and observers. My name is Wendy Isaac, and I'm making this oral submission on behalf of the Legal Resources Center and People Opposing Women Abuse, primarily because we both organizations submitted a joint submission to the committee. We thank this committee for providing us with the opportunity to make the submissions and commend Parliament for the enactment of the Domestic Violence Act. Legislation which, in our view, does have the potential, if it's effectively implemented, to protect women and children from domestic abuse. Our submission intends to do two things, or address two issues. Firstly, to bring to the attention of the committee the various challenges and obstacles which hinder effective implementation, and secondly, to make specific recommendations that will strengthen the existing legislative and policy framework for the benefit of abused women and children. The effective implementation and enforcement of the law is central to ensuring that all survivors, particularly women and children, enjoy all their constitutionally protected rights. In addition to an effective criminal justice system facilitating the arrest, prosecution, and punishment of perpetrators, the most effective response to violence against women is a clear demonstration of political will backed by a commitment of resources by the state. In this regard, our submission addresses two major interrelated concerns, the first being the implementation challenges within the civil and criminal justice system, and the second being the need for government to demonstrate this political will by allocating sufficient resources to ensure an effective response to domestic violence. I start off with a brief note on the legal responsibility of the state. Basically, Section 7.2 of the Constitution establishes the duty of the state to respect, protect, promote, and fulfill all the rights in the Bill of Rights. In December 1995, South Africa signed and ratified the CEDAW Convention to end all forms of discrimination against women and acceded to the protocol, the optional protocol to CEDAW on 18 October 2005. Further to these commitments, the Parliament passed the Domestic Violence Act in 1998. However, despite the adoption of the Act, the adoption of the South African Police Service's National Instructions in 1999 and the guidelines to assist magistrates, which were adopted in July 2008 in adjudicating domestic violence cases, domestic violence continues unabated and perpetrators enjoy widespread impunity. It is an established principle of international law that a state will be legally accountable for breaches of international obligations under customary or treaty law when it fails to exercise due diligence to prevent, control, correct, or discipline private acts of violence through its executive, legislative, or judicial organs. The groundbreaking General Recommendation 19 on Violence Against Women explicitly recognized that violence against women is a form of discrimination that seriously inhibits women's ability to enjoy rights and freedoms on the basis of equality with men, and that family violence is one of the most insidious forms of violence against women. For the purposes of this submission, the exercise of due diligence requires that the state not only enact legislation which punishes domestic violence, but that the state additionally adopts a policy to prevent violations by engaging in societal transformation aimed at addressing systemic forms of domination and oppression of women in our society. In other words, the duty to transform the patriarchal gender structures and values that sustain gender inequality and entrench violence against women. In this regard, we have a number of specific recommendations. I won't list all of them because they are in the written submission. I'll just highlight a few. The first being that we urge the government to speak out forcefully on the urgent need to end violence against women, particularly domestic violence, and ensure public accountability for all instances of violence. Secondly, we urge the government to provide funding or to increase the current funding so that adequate services are provided, including shelters for abused women and children and access to justice and redress for survivors. We urge the government to take measures to ensure that no state actors commit acts of domestic violence, including taking punitive or disciplinary action against any state agent who does, and prevent violence against women by non-state actors, prosecute and punish all perpetrators, and provide remedies and redress to victims. An important note in adjudicating domestic violence cases, we urge that the relevant state agents give due consideration to the safety of women, emphasizing that perpetrators' rights cannot supersede women's human rights to life and physical and mental integrity. Perpetrators' rights in this regard may be, for example, the right to continue occupying the common household simply because they are also part owner of the house. In the course of our work, which includes both the LRC and people opposing women abuse, includes both legal service provision and litigation which advances women's rights, we have identified a number of problematic trends. Firstly, while the 2008 guidelines for magistrates in various sections of the Act clearly set out the considerations that judicial officers should bear in mind when granting or refusing interim protection orders, in practice, the legislation and guidelines are not adhered to. In numerous jurisdictions, complainants have reported secondary victimization in family courts. For instance, instead of being granted an interim protection order when they apply for one, they're often turned away or issued with a notice to show cause, even though the matter is urgent and life-threatening. Magistrates are often reluctant to grant orders that evict perpetrators from the common household or extend monetary relief to complainants, despite overwhelming evidence presented in the application. In numerous cases, matters are postponed by magistrates who request that the parties should obtain legal representation. This frustrates the complainant as many cannot afford legal representation, and perpetrators use this to delay proceedings, resulting in not only the abuse of legal process, but also perpetuating the cycle of abuse which was initially complained of. Whilst the Act provides that complainants may have access to a court at any time, the reality is that most family courts only hear domestic violence during court hours, resulting in complainants not receiving the immediate assistance which is often required. There's further no independent party that considers the interests of minors during domestic violence proceedings. We have a few recommendations in response to these challenges. I won't read all of them, but basically the general idea is to urge magistrates to adhere to the 2008 guidelines on dealing with domestic violence matters, because they clearly set out all the considerations to be taken into account when adjudicating such cases. We have two recommendations around the court system. We suggest that a specialized or integrated court system be established to deal with domestic violence matters. Many of the problems which arise from adjudicating domestic violence cases in South Africa are due to an uncoordinated judicial system. And it is our recommendation that South Africa develops its domestic violence court system by doing one of two things. Firstly, increasing the specialization of domestic violence courts and moving towards the integration of criminal and civil aspects of domestic violence matters. Secondly, looking at best practice models in other jurisdictions in order to draw on the experience and develop a system that works for South Africa. This will ultimately speak to the separation of the criminal and civil aspects of domestic violence, particularly in a situation where if there is a violation of the protection order, the criminal court often does not take into account that there was an existing protection order against the perpetrator, and therefore the cycle of abuse is not brought into the or the history of abuse is not brought into the fore. There are a number of challenges relating to the South African Police Services. Again, there are 1999 national instructions for South African Police Services, which together with the Act set out very clear duties or legal duties which police should abide by. But we have, of course, noted numerous inconsistencies and ultimately contravention of applicable law and policy. Number one, there's a routine failure to investigate telephonic complaints due to vehicle shortages. There's a routine failure to arrest perpetrators without a warrant at the incidents of domestic violence. We've received reports from complainants of SAPS, failure to assist with service of court process, and there's a routine failure to keep domestic violence records and advise complainants of rights to lay criminal charges in addition to seeking legal redress in terms of the Act. These issues, read together, read individually, all demonstrate a general dereliction of duties by SAPS members in certain jurisdictions in terms of domestic violence cases. The second part of the submission deals with allocation of adequate resources. Here, state allocation of adequate resources and funding is the most significant policy tool of government in responding to violence against women. The National Crime Prevention Strategy of 1996 established crimes of violence against women and children as a national priority. And in order to give full effect to the provisions of the Act, the government must allocate a budget that necessitates effective implementation. Here are classical examples from POA's work will assist in breaking down this issue. POA operates two shelters for abused women and children in the Gauteng area and employs qualified social workers and auxiliary social workers to provide psychosocial support for abused women. POA receives government funding for these areas of work from the Department of Social Development, but the funding is broken down as follows. 105,000 rand per annum for a social worker's salary. This funding excludes operational costs and programmatic costs such as facilitating support groups for abused women. 96,000 rand per annum for an auxiliary social worker salary, which also excludes operational and programmatic costs. 25 rand per day per abused woman in the shelter. There is no funding for the children that the abused women may come into the shelter for. There is no funding for skills development for women while they are at the shelter, and also no funding for operational costs for the shelter house. The financial resources received from the Department of Social Development are wholly inadequate to provide the necessary and urgent support to women and children affected by domestic violence. Poor's constituency, and primarily also the LRC's constituency, are predominantly under-resourced and often unskilled black women who do not only require shelter from perpetrators but further need empowerment to enable them to break the cycle of abuse and end their financial dependence on male perpetrators. The current socioeconomic position of women in the country does not enable women to break free from violence in their homes without the assistance of civil society organizations, and therefore the assistance from government of the allocation of adequate resources. In this respect, there's a long section on adequate resources in the written submission. I won't take too much time with that. But in this respect, we have two major recommendations. The first being that we urge the government to address the issue of under-resourcing and under-prioritization within implementing agencies of the Act. For example, the Department of Justice has often complained of the lack of or insufficient numbers of clerks in different courts. Women then are often turned away because there aren't sufficient clerks to assist them with the application for protection orders. SAS has complained of lack of vehicles to serve protection orders and to respond to incidents of domestic violence. So they are beyond the provision of shelter services that I've specifically spoken about. Within government agencies, there isn't sufficient funding to enable state agents to respond effectively to domestic violence. The second recommendation is very particular. We urge the government to review the Department of Social Development's policy on financial awards, such as review the process to be conducted in consultation with non-governmental organizations which provide shelters and psychosocial services to abused women and their children in the shelters. Just a few concluding remarks. These submissions have focused on the key challenges to implementation of the Act by firstly examining the civil and criminal justice system, secondly evaluating the adequate allocation of resources and funding, and thirdly, identifying shortcomings in government's response to domestic violence. We've made a number of recommendations. While we are mindful of the positive strides that Parliament has taken in affording protection and benefits to survivors of domestic violence by enacting the Domestic Violence Act, we are of the view that there is still much work to be done to ensure that government does meet not only its constitutional but also its international law obligations to respond or to act with due diligence to respond to violence against women, and in this particular instance, domestic violence. And part of that response should be the allocation of adequate resources for shelters, for psychosocial services, for legal services, for the Department of Justice to extend legal aid to abused women in particular. We hope that these recommendations and suggestions will be taken on board and ensure the effective implementation of the Act. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The presentation sounded very clear and straight to the point. So I will give an opportunity to members to raise concerns for now. But quite a lot of issues were raised. Perpetrators' rights should not supersede the victim's rights. Cases postponed or prolonged. No sense of agency, specialized courts needed. Issue of best practices. Telephonic complaints not being handled well. Under prioritization. I think all the issues that have been raised is what we all agree. And the issue of the legislation being under-resourced, that those are the main concerns. But can I give an opportunity to members to ask questions, concerns? Is there another hand? Okay, let's have the two of you. I don't know. Members, are you not in a good mood today?
We are.
Honorable Kekane. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. And I want to thank the presenter for this well-prepared and quite, you know, clear presentation. As the chair has indicated, and I think also my colleagues here have also agreed that, you know, everything that, you know, almost everything that you have presented is what has been identified, and we quite agree with it. And Chair, I also just have one question, and the question is during your presentation towards, you know, what you are expected to spend your finance on. You indicated, amongst others, that operational costs are not being covered by the costs. So I would be interested to hear as to where do you get funding for operational costs. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you again for the presentation. It was quite clear, like our Chairperson has already said. I just want to, it's a comment actually, the issue about shared residence, which I think is still a very serious issue, and I think a perpetrator here must move out. And on the victim side, I think also it is really second abuse if we think about it on a very serious note. But still, the victim must be protected because the perpetrator might come back and there could be a situation of murder, even before the case could even go to court. And on shelters, it's a question from your organization. Are your shelters also catering for persons with disabilities? Thank you, Chairperson.
Okay, Kala.
Thanks, Chair. You spoke about the international legislation, which also guides all countries, I suppose. I don't know if you've managed to look at what are their experiences in terms of domestic violence. Are they coping with it? Are they experiencing? I would imagine, because we all come from a patriarchal society, even in rich countries, you still get this. But are they doing better than us in terms of implementing it and addressing this issue of domestic violence? Or is it just as bad as we are?
Thanks. I will give you an opportunity to answer. And also, I think also what we need to highlight very well is the perception that is created by mainly us as women, the perception that says the act is mainly created for women, you know. And I think it's just a perception. It's not so. It's just that men, they hold on very much to their dignity. They do not want to come out forward and tell us what their sufferings are. Even in this hearing, we struggled to get a male that was going to be brave enough. So we realized that men, although they are perpetrators, but they are not very brave as they are supposed to be. Because we could not get a male that was going to come here and tell us kutubethwa kanjani yena. Also, we realize that when you do go to police stations to report as male counterparts, it's a big job for the male, which is very unfair. You get men that are emotionally abused, and I really feel for them. We don't want that to happen to our men, don't we? We don't want that. We love our men, and we respect them. We expect the same from them. So we need to address that issue, you know, on a serious note. Our men are suffering, some of them. Let's not be biased. Over to you. Can you then respond?
Thank you. Thank you for the questions. Let me start with the last one on my reference to best practices. There is a 2006 report from the United Nations Secretary General, an in-depth study on violence against women. That report, which is probably the most recent on study on violence against women from the UN, which looked at all countries in the world and member states' responses to violence against women, found that there is no country in the world which has invested sufficient resources to respond effectively to violence against women. Now, there isn't a country in the world, for example, which has, again, met the requirements of the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, which fully respects those commitments. So when I talk of practices that we could probably draw from other jurisdictions, let me not say best practices, let me say promising practices. What is useful, though, when one looks at international law is that the CEDAW committee has considered two communications which deal with domestic violence. The most relevant one to the South African context is a decision which was handed down by the CEDAW committee against the country of Austria. Austria's model of domestic violence, though it's a first world country in Europe, is very similar to South Africa's model. In fact, the mechanisms that they've put in place, the legislation, the provision of shelter, the provision of, or the funding of shelters, at least from the government, is quite similar. But what was interesting, and I think some points that came from the first two members' questions around perpetrators' access to the household, what was interesting was that despite those mechanisms and procedures and policies being put in place, a woman was still ultimately killed by her abusive husband despite a court order. And she was killed by her abusive husband because the court refused to issue an eviction order in line with the protection order, because the district court felt that you can't deprive a perpetrator of his right to a home. What happened, and what should be of particular interest to us in South Africa, would be that civil society organizations in that country took the government of Austria to the CEDAW committee to say that this issue needs to be clarified. Again, that's why I made reference to rights of victims should not be subordinated to the rights of the perpetrator. So there are some interesting developments in terms of international law. There are some practices that we can pick out. There are some decisions from the CEDAW committee, from the European Court, which speak directly to domestic violence. There's a recent decision from the European Court on Human Rights against Turkey, again, on this very issue of how do you protect a woman from a perpetrator who goes back to the common household. And court orders have been issued against governments where they fail to do that. In terms of the question around whether our shelters, not our, I work at the LRC, whether poor shelters provide shelter for people or children with disabilities, I cannot say with absolute certainty that they do. I do not have the precise information around that, but having previously worked at POA, the premises are such that they would allow access for a person on a wheelchair. It's designed to allow everybody without discrimination. In terms of the operational costs, where does the rest of the money come from? POA is funded by both Department of Social Development for its psychosocial and shelter work, but also by independent donors. One has to be, the organization has been very creative. Since 1984, they've been running these shelters. They've had to be very creative to be able to keep the shelters running. The reality, though, is that in the absence of appropriate funding from government, because private donors do not fund shelters, they also do not fund, they don't give core costs. What has happened is that the women at the shelters have not had any kind of, it's been very difficult to institute empowering skills for the women at the shelter, so people stay there unemployed and without, so that is an urgent requirement. Hopefully I've answered the question. Thank you.
So those also are some of the problematic areas, because the Act talks about shelters, but it's supposed to house these victims, and on the other hand, government does not fund shelters. So it's like a contradiction on our side. Yeah. So we need to criticize ourselves before anyone can do that. Members, are you satisfied now? Can we release Paul? Thank you very much. We'll keep in touch. We then have a second presenter, Ms. Alida Prince. Is she around? Sim, you want to say something?
No, I was saying the document which is going to be presented is not part of the package. It's not on the program. It's not, you know, written like other documents, DVA something, and so forth.
It's not in the package. It could be an oral submission.
Okay.
But is Alida here? It's not there. That doesn't look like. And then we have, again, Professor Anika Givers. Is Professor here? If you could, you know, come here. Come forward. If the submission is not in the package, then it's usually just an oral submission. Professor, you can just kick off if you are ready.
Good morning, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, and ladies and gentlemen. My name is Anik Givers, and I thought I would give you a little bit of background. I'm trained as a clinical psychologist. I train in the United States. I specialize in women and gender studies and child and adolescent mental health. Most of my clinical work was done in a clinic that offered comprehensive and multidisciplinary investigation, advocacy, and treatment services to child and adolescent trauma survivors and their non-offending family members. And then, much to my delight, I got the opportunity to move back to South Africa, where I've been part of a team working to develop a school-based program to prevent intimate partner violence and promote healthy relationships among young adolescents. Thank you very much for giving me time to speak today. According to the Domestic Violence Act, the state is committed to the elimination of domestic violence. However, the Act does not provide a strong enough framework to assist in meeting this goal because there are no provision clauses in relation to the prevention of domestic violence. Targeting children and adolescents for prevention services is particularly important, not only because of the negative impact of domestic violence on this group, but also because we need to establish healthy, non-violent norms at a very early age. Various research on children and adolescents that are exposed to domestic violence have found that there's a really high likelihood that they too will be abused or maltreated in their homes. In fact, I would say that witnessing domestic violence itself is could be considered traumatic. They usually experience physical and mental health problems as a result of this trauma, including post-traumatic stress symptoms, such as mood disturbances and behavioral problems. Domestic violence can disrupt children and adolescents' psychological, social, and physical development. And of most concern, I think, is that they are learning an unhealthy model of relationships and become more likely to perpetrate violence and or be victimized in their own relationships, which just perpetuates the cycle of violence across generations. So even if we were to offer effective and appropriate comprehensive psychosocial, medical, and welfare services to affected youth and their caregivers that may contribute to preventing the reoccurrence of domestic violence within their lives, these effects, and international research has shown this, are unlikely to prevent domestic violence at a societal level. That is, such services may help those children and families who receive them, but there is little evidence suggesting that it contributes to lower levels of domestic violence in society and creating a healthier society for us all. Currently, the Act clearly supports post-violence efforts, but these alone will not eliminate domestic violence in our country. Therefore, we should prevent domestic violence from occurring the first time by implementing programs that promote healthy relationships among youth. These efforts aim to minimize the number of people who perpetrate and are victimized by domestic violence, and these programs would be called the primary prevention programs. So what kind of primary prevention programs are likely to be successful? First of all, we want to intervene as early as possible. That is, targeting programs at children, adolescents, and those influential in their lives, such as parents, other caregivers, schools, and youth groups, are most likely to have a lasting and meaningful impact on our society in ways that will not only rid it of domestic violence, but also contribute to creating a healthy and vibrant environment for us all. Prevention programs for youth will help to establish healthy relationship norms. Secondly, programs should address the underlying factors. International and local researchers have found that domestic violence is more likely to occur in societies where the use of violence is normative, particularly when violence is witnessed during childhood. Another risk is societies where gender inequality manifests in women having relatively less power than men in a variety of domains, and men having limited ways to express their male identity, and feeling that women should be under their control and should be punished if they transgress gender norms. Further, alcohol use tends to exacerbate domestic violence, and these are all issues that we are facing in South Africa. So it is these underlying factors that need to be targeted in primary prevention programs. And given that domestic violence is found in all groups of our society, it is important that all groups, men and women, boys and girls, are engaged in prevention efforts. In my interviews with adolescents that I conducted to inform work that the Respect for You team at BCP is doing, we discussed intimate relationships. And there are two issues that arose that are relevant to this discussion. First of all, experiences of violence in relationships are already prevalent among adolescents. Local researchers have found that almost half of adolescents in South Africa report experiencing different forms of violence in their intimate relationships. Secondly, these adolescents indicated to me their desire for a program to help them with relationship issues, particularly one that would build their skills so that they would know how to build a healthy relationship. Programs will need to be evidence-based. Given that we do not have limitless resources to invest in primary prevention, it is really important that programs be evidence-based and developed or tested locally so that we know what we are doing will be effective. Further, in order to ensure continued effectiveness of these programs, they need to be continuously monitored and evaluated and revised as necessary. Unfortunately, there are relatively few evidence-based programs for youth focusing on preventing intimate partner violence, but the good news is that there are some and still more currently being developed. For example, a team at the Gender and Health Research Unit at the MRC developed and tested the Stepping Stones program with youth and found it to be particularly successful in engaging men and facilitating a positive change in their behavior, including decreases in violent behavior. And as I mentioned, I'm working on a team right now that is developing an intervention that can be integrated into the life orientation curriculum for grade 8. So it is interventions such as these that need to be scaled up. And as I mentioned earlier, prevention interventions need to be coordinated to offer consistent information, messages, skills and services to all groups in our society. Further, successful prevention is going to require collaboration between and within government departments, as well as between government and civil society organizations, in order to most effectively address the great need that domestic violence presents in our society. So if the state is committed to eliminating domestic violence from our society, and I think we all agree on that, then it is imperative that we build in provision for primary prevention in the Act and then implement it in effective and sustainable ways. I think it is useful for us to conceptualize responses to and the services for domestic violence along a continuum, stretching from primary prevention with all groups, targeted prevention with at-risk groups, and post-violent secondary prevention for victims, survivors, and perpetrators. The link between HIV and intimate partner violence provides yet more impetus that the prevention of domestic violence is a matter of great importance and great urgency. And I hope that today is just the beginning of a dialogue and, more importantly, action to address this issue and incorporate prevention on the national agenda. Thank you.
We welcome all the ideas, especially you dealt mainly with the prevention part of it. But I just thought perhaps you would touch a bit on the changes that you think could be done to the legislation. Changes or what ideas do you have around the Act itself?
I think that provision can be made for resources to be allocated to prevention programs. I think that would be the first step, and then also I think secondary prevention is just as important as primary prevention, but right now there is little attention to primary prevention, and if all of the services on the secondary prevention and the protection and treatment side are burdened, perhaps one way to deal with that is to minimize the number of people that need those services by preventing domestic violence from occurring in the first place.
It makes sense. You know, in Zulu, there's a saying that says, "Ukotwa use manzi." Huh? It actually means, you know, the little bark or a stick of a tree. You can bend it while it's still very fresh and young. Once it's old, it becomes a problem. I think this is the very same case in this. Yeah. Okay. Do we have concerns, questions, Honorable Ketane? And can I welcome the two members that have just joined us, the two members of Parliament that have joined us. Welcome to the committee. No, three members. One, two, three. Welcome to the committee. Honorable Ketane, Honorable Dorothy, Honorable Pearl.
I'm interested where you're talking about norms. Where you're saying that it is better to prevent it from happening for the first time, because if it happens, even if you have support programs to remedy it at a societal level, is very difficult to control. In other words, you become kind of an incurable disease. It will happen generation after generation for as long as it has happened for the first time. Now, you see, the other problem that you are facing is not just the criminality of it. It is a whole cultural thing. Up to today in our society, it's very difficult to convince the old generation that violence, for example, you know, violence, like Cher spoke about, because I said, and in English, the concept of spare the rod, spoil the child. A lot of societal members still believe things are going wrong because at school, children are normal, there's no more corporal punishment. At home, children have rights, and you can't even lift a stick against them, and they believe if you spread the rod, you're spoiling the child. Now, we're coming from that culture where violence was supposed to be used positively for corrective measures. And now, if you drop it all together, I mean, our society, to a very large extent, don't be, in fact, even the wife are supposed to be part of your children as a man in the patriarchy. And if she goes astray, you could take a little stick and give her a little hiding. So a lot of, and there were no divorces according to them because you could correct. Now, this thing of totally even, I just wanted to comment where it is supposed to have been used positively, at school and at home. Psychologically, indeed, that must be dropped off altogether.
Thank you, Chairperson, and let me also thank Anik Givas. Am I spelling it right? Okay. Anik Givas, yes. Let me thank you for your presentation. I just have one question. I think I'm largely covered by my colleague there, because I think what the Chairperson also alluded to is true. But then I think I just want to find out as to, you know, having these such useful, you know, and very, very, very important ideas, at what level are you able to influence, or how do you impact, and where, at what level, where are you contributing, you know, these ideas to, these ideas that you are party with us? I'm saying they are beautiful ideas, very useful. At which point are you able to interact with the sectors that you have mentioned here, the youth, the children, especially at school? Where is this information being fed into?
I'm not getting the question. Are you meaning right now, whether it is doing any
programs? Yes. Programs.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think I'm answered in some of the questions. And I just want to say, it's a comment actually, that psychologically I think it is more on children, because eventually they grow up being abusive too in their relationships. And it's good anyway to see that the programs have been designed actually specifically for youth who are there to build the relationship skills. My question is, how do you contribute on persons with disabilities? Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Chairperson. I'm looking at, you know, when you speak about evidence-based reporting and investigating and treatment, what examples or what can a person learn from the international research? You know, just shortly offhand. Because we do have empowerment centers. Some are adolescent friendly, but sometimes all children cannot be accommodated. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. To start off with the question about, I suppose, the corrective use of violence or corporal punishment, I think that that is extremely problematic because we're teaching our children and our youth that it's okay to use violence sometimes. And I think there are many other more effective and also positive ways to change behavior, or to punish or to correct behavior of children in schools, in homes, and wherever. And I think that the, off the top of my head, the research on behaviorism in terms of positive reinforcement, so using things to build up the positive, might be helpful to address those things and maybe build those skills in people that work with youth a lot. And I also would like to say that though my presentation focused on primary prevention, I still think that secondary prevention can still be helpful, and we should not discount the resilience of children and adolescents. I don't think it is a foregone conclusion that if they experience domestic violence, that they themselves will continue to experience violence or become perpetrators of violence. However, the risk is there. Currently, to answer the question about where I'm working, currently my work is in the schools in Cape Town to test this intervention to see if it does work. Is there anything more that you want to know about that?
No, thank you, Chairperson. I think when you are saying in Cape Town, are you still putting it on test? Are you intending taking it to other provinces?
So right now we are testing to see if it works and to revise it to make sure that the program that we do want to roll out does work and is the best program that we can possibly develop. So yes, hopefully it will be taken up by other provinces.
Thank you again, Chairperson. You know, yesterday there was someone who made a presentation, and one of the recommendations that he was making, it was for the children to be monitored when they're watching a television. Have you been able to look into that? And if so, how do you think we can do that?
I think that monitoring in general of children and their activities, not only television but maybe also internet use, other electronic media including Mixit, is really important. And the research certainly supports the protective effect of parental monitoring on child and adolescent risk behavior and behavior in general. So I think that even just rules at home, or frankly, if our TV programming is only offering inappropriate material, perhaps we need to take that up with the people that make those decisions about what programs to show. Can I continue answering questions? And then in terms of the contribution to persons with disabilities, our program, we would hope that it would not discriminate, that it would be available to all. Right now it is a school-based program, so it would depend on the youth being at school, but I think that this program, there is potential for it to be implemented in other areas as well.
Chairperson, thank you, Chairperson. What about those with CP cases, you know, cerebral palsy?
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with the issue?
With the relationship issues?
Yeah.
Well, I think there are two ways. And I'm talking specifically now about the program that I'm working on, but, I mean, other programs could definitely be developed. I think that it would obviously require the special education teachers that work with those youth or the service providers that work with those youth to adapt the program, because they could, you know, use the manual to adapt it to their specific population, because it is there's a lot of sort of interactive exercises and those kinds of things. But also in terms of, I think the program is more widely applicable than just to intimate relationships. It's teaching children relationship skills across the board, so relationships, just peer relationships, and so that I think if we can get children to think about being more respectful with many different others, that could also be extended to the people with disabilities community. And then in terms of the evidence-based work, what can we learn from international programs? Internationally, there has been quite a bit of research. Again, most of it does focus on secondary prevention, but there is definitely primary prevention work that has been done in terms of interventions in different settings with adults and with children. And I think that a review of that literature that is available would be really helpful, just so that we can learn from that and then adapt it to our current situation and the cultural issues here and those kinds of things.
Honorable Lepenya.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Thank you, Professor, for the wonderful presentation. My interest is with regard to you dealing with young people, that how do you find a link between, you know, there are young people who actually do drug abuse, which, you know, eventually impacts on the family situation as well? How do you try to find a way of also trying to protect parents? Because, you know, as our chairperson correctly put it, that domestic violence is a very broad issue, but people tend to think that it is only violence against women. But it is a broad issue because these young people will actually, you know, do what their peers are doing out there without, you know, being influenced by the situation at home and actually come back and abuse their parents at home. So how do you try to find a link in that? If you've had programs already, is there any impact, especially here in Cape Town? Because I was heard you when I heard you saying that you are doing your pilot program here in Cape Town, that have you observed any impact with regard to trying to address that part of the problem? Thank you, Chair.
I think that alcohol and drug use is definitely a huge problem on its own, but also how it impacts on violence is definitely problematic. While our program does not focus specifically on drug and alcohol use prevention, it does integrate issues around drug and alcohol use within relationship contexts. But there are drug and alcohol use prevention programs. There was one that was piloted, and I believe they're in the second stage of piloting in KwaZulu-Natal at the moment, and it's around an HIV and alcohol prevention study that has been piloted in schools. So I think that these programs, I mean, there are multiple facets of these programs and multiple programs, and we might need to look at how the programs can be integrated to be more comprehensive.
Yes, I'm still interested at the philosophical, the normative part of what you're explaining. The issue that generally, if we avoid using violence as a solution to problems, that will produce a better society. My prediction that there is that it looks like we're just surrounded naturally by so much violence. I mean, if we're eating lambs or chicken, or we have to slaughter them, and that is violence, using violence positively. No, I'm saying this because I know that some nature conservationists are vegetarian because they are just against that it is. But the point is that if you look at Johannesburg, they slaughter every abattoir the 15,000 sheep a day to supply the market, and 10,000 cattle a day to supply the market. So we just surrounded so by so much violence that I don't know if we'll ever manage a society without that, because our own survival, it looks like, depends on that. Best of human beings is so violent also. And I'd like you to comment, you know, whether we'll ever get control and avoid violence and be a better society.
Are you saying that because we are living, it's difficult for us to be correct because we are living in an incorrect world?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, thanks for saying what.
I would say that it is not only about avoiding violence, but also about creating healthy norms. So we can't, and I think that is not only going to be done by avoiding violence, because as you correctly point out, violence is pervasive in our society, and this is a societal problem that is going to need the entire society to get on board to deal with this problem. And if including eating meat and giving birth is in your inclusion of problematic violence, I think that those are some uses of violence we might not be able to get around. But I certainly do think I will never give up hope that we can live in a generally non-violent society, and if that begins with non-violence within human interactions, then I think that is a fantastic beginning.
Members of the legislature, any comments?
None.
Thank you. I just would like to know from her experience what then the role of the family would be. Because in my view, I think the nurturing, you know, the molding of this tender tweak, first and foremost, should happen in the family. But looks like we are institutionalizing almost everything. So I'm just wondering whether, according to this model that you have, whether family still has any role to play in keeping this violence. Thank you.
I think that family has a central role to addressing the issue of violence in our society, and they certainly do have a lot of influence over the youth. I think that given that parenting is often such an incredibly difficult task that people are faced with, that maybe we can do more to support families, that we can do more to support parents in the way that they parent. And also in the interventions that I have been describing, I think it is essential for us to engage families in them, because if we teach them at school about having respectful relationships and how to do that, but they go home and those relationships are characterized by disrespect, disrespectful interaction, then we're not going to see the change that we want to see. So I think it is essential that we engage with families and parents when we are doing work with youth.
Thank you very much. Thanks very much, Alida. And also thank you very much for the contribution you're trying to make at your young age. The first presenter also was very young, and I think we are honored by your contribution as young, you know, young people with all the stamina, unlike us. Half of the stamina is already gone. So thanks for that. Thank you very much, and good luck. Can I check whether Alida Prince is in now? No. Okay. Can we then move on to check whether the Center for the Study of Violence and Reconciliation is around? Ria. Are you ready? Are you fine now? Okay, you can begin there.
Okay, thanks very much. Good morning to the committee. The Center for the Study of Violence and Reconciliation would like to thank the opportunity to giving to civil society to make inputs in this hearing. And in November 2008, the CSVR hosted a conference to assess the implementation of the Domestic Violence Act. Copies of the conference report have been made available to the committee, and most of the problems that we have been hearing about these days were raised in that conference last year, but you do have the copies. But today I'm going to focus more on the role of police in the implementation of the Domestic Violence Act. Cops left me to be raped. Police refused to enforce protection order. This was a headline in the Spanish paper in September 2007. Police refused to enforce a protection order when a woman tearfully begged the police to rescue her from her child sex abuser and mental patient ex-husband. The police accused her of being drunk. Talk nicely to this man, they said, because he's talking nicely to you. After the three officers refused to arrest the HIV positive former husband, despite the protection order she had obtained against him, the man in a drunken rage raped her. The woman sued the South African Police Service and won the case where the judge, Leon Kent, was escaping in his condemnation of the police, describing the evidence as deliberately deceitful and riddled with improbabilities and lies. That's the reality we have in the country right now in terms of the role of the police in implementing the act. But also, who is a good cop? The citizen expects police officers to have the wisdom of Solomon, the courage of David, the strength of Samson, the patience of God, the stability of Alexander, the faith of Daniel, the diplomacy of Lincoln, the tolerance of the carpenter of Nazareth, and finally, the intimate knowledge of every branch of natural, biological, and social sciences. If he had all this, he would be a good policeman. This was said by August Berman, who was a police chief in the U.S. in California in 1905. And I'm quoting this because I think it still resonates with the reality of our country, particularly the implementation of the act. We have put a lot of emphasis on the role of police. And I say that the issue is that even though they are a key actor, we need to look at the domestic violence problem more holistically. But again, I'm going to focus on the police role today. The act gives, this is the purpose of the act, affords victims of domestic violence the maximum protection from domestic abuse that the law can provide. Then there are a lot of specific duties for the police. Assist the informed complaint on his or her rights. At the domestic violence scene, render whatever assistance is necessary. Serve the protection order together with a warrant for arrest on the respondent. Arrest the respondent if there is a reason to suspect that the complainant may have suffered injury or harm. Find any firearms that could be killed or harm the complainant. And also the domestic violence incident to report to the police station must be recorded in the domestic violence register. And this is a responsibility of the station commander. And last but not least, the South African Police and the IECD are obliged to report on the South African Police Service compliance with the DVA every 6 months to the police portfolio. These are the duties. We should be doing this right now. Now, what is happening? In general terms, there is an inadequate and efficient police response to domestic violence as a result of both institutional violence and individual abuse on domestic violence. In the implementation of the DVA, there is a lack of human, material, and financial resources to implement the act. The police records do not identify the relationship between victim and perpetrator. Violation of protection orders only touch as such without reciprocal criminal charges, so we are just prosecuting the kids that are waiting for a lesser crime. The stated reasons behind the DVA are not fully understood. There is no risk assessment conducted. For instance, police are not renewed with firearms. Discussion of the police officer on whether or not to arrest the respondent and the guidelines are unclear. arrests are seldom effected. And there are allegations from police stations, actually, police are actually orders, where they're saying only if you witness at the violence, you can arrest the perpetrator. So that's been alleged by women's organizations. The investigation of the police to reduce crime statistics. So the police are discharged to report at the select complainants directly to the court for protection orders or refer complainants for counseling. More problematic too, sometimes police act as mediators or counselors in order to deflect cases or deal with the matter at the family level, without encouraging properly training counseling of this type of situations. And there is the failure of the registered cases at the police stations. This limits our understanding and of the extent of the problem in the country. At the individual level, in a way, patriarchal views among some police officials. That means that the denial of efficient service to victims of domestic violence. The dislike of sending protection orders because of difficulties locating respondents, also for lack of actual resources. The domestic violence is always even serious when it involves physical violence. Only those cases amount to serious and violent crime and are investigated, therefore. There are also some other serious issues in the police service. There are high levels of domestic violence within the police service itself, and that should be dealt with because it's somehow like you are asking them to police this and they are committing also violence. The last time they interfere when it's seen as family squabbles, it's not seen as a crime. Domestic violence is not a crime in some police people's minds. Failure to recognize the danger facing victims and failure to take the steps to protect them. And of course, a lack of access to the South African police service to vulnerable populations, gay and lesbian, couples, migrant and refugee women. The CSG has been doing research with migrant women in the country recently, and they report really, they just cannot go to the police station. They cannot go undocumented migrants, they're just too scared to go to the police station to report violence that are suffering at the hands of their countrymen. Outline responsibilities of other role players. Again, we focus a lot on the role of the police, but we don't have enough around the availability of services for victims such as shelters where the police can send the victims. And there's of course a put oversight of the Domestic Violence Act, three reports by the ICD and the South African Police Service to Parliament. Recommendations. First of all, the police should develop a 5-year study plan for the effective policing of domestic violence, with clear goals, timelines, and targets for the implementation, and of course with the necessary budget allocation. What should this plan be put, for instance, a standard on training of domestic violence, social context capacity building should be included, and a social training on a growing basis. But also we need to have much more innovative methods for training, because at different times, public service and police, too, they really tell us all this training. We need to have some much more interesting ways to deal with the cases. For instance, a clear review of the cases handling. Not just to get external NGOs to go and give lecture, but more like interaction among the police on how they deal with cases. The police need to approach their work with professionalism and within a legal and human rights framework. The police response should not be domestic violence act only, but needs to for creative ways of dealing more effectively with withdrawals or situations where victims do not want to lay charges but protection is still required. Because you know that women sometimes do not want really to send, you know, their husband or their partner to prison if they're the only breadwinner, but they still need protection. Then, of course, a general one, the specialized unit within the South African Police Service dealing with domestic violence and sexual violence needs to be re-established and with adequate resources. We have been hearing that it seems the idea is to come back to the unit, and we really welcome hopefully the decision, but also we just need to resource them appropriately. It's not enough to have them there. Then, rather than trying to reduce crime statistics, the police should be encouraged to record the statistics. And it goes back to the idea of recording domestic violence incidents. The ICD should have their powers broadened. Disciplinary action needs to be taken against police members failing in their duties in terms of the DVA or offering substandard service. The public needs to be made aware of the complaint mechanism for poor service. And a study needs to be put in place to tighten the managerial oversight of police officers who are dealing with domestic violence. But again, going back to my first thing, there is a role for the police, but this is to be beyond the police only. now we should go beyond the criminal justice system response. We have a 365-based national action plan to end violence against women. There is a focus on prevention there, but it's very weak. There are no resources or clear strategies around prevention. Again, with prevention, one size does not fit all. Primary prevention of domestic violence needs to be a long-term, community-specific, well-resourced intervention. And actually, I very much welcome also the presentation of the previous speaker, Rika Sri. I think really kind of was very, very clear on the need for prevention. There are also regarding this national strategy to address domestic violence. We believe it should be the new Ministry for Women, Children, and People with Disabilities. This ministry, we don't know quite what are they supposed to be doing, and as we think that the committee should be the one to, you know, to call them and ask them what are they going to do about this. So the committee should use its oversight powers and call upon relevant government departments and the new ministry to follow concrete strategies to address domestic violence in a holistic and coordinated fashion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Could I hand over to the members of as well? You know, you talk about the issue of the protection order. And the issue of not opening charges. So that is what victims need to understand. The protection order is something else. Opening a charge is something else. But usually what happens, they would just give a protection order and off you go. So no charges have been opened. But I'm glad your emphasis was mainly on the role of the police. I know the role of the police mainly would be to apprehend the perpetrator. But here you have said it all. What do we do in a case where police do not do what they are supposed to do? Can I open to members? My co-chair next to me, Honorable Mabe, Duncan, Detecello, who else? Okay, those are the hands for now.
Thank you, Chair.
Who is a good cop?
You ever say that citizens expect police officers to have the wisdom of Solomon. And in cases of conflict, in situations of conflict, you'd expect individuals to act as mediators. I want to quote what you said earlier on, that in most cases, yes, I've also heard of that, that the police would say, talk nice to this man. What are you recommending? Are you saying that at no point that police officers should act as mediators, or they should not play any reconciliatory action? Their duty is just to implement the law.
Thank you, Chair. For saving some time, I've written my question, so I will read it. Chairperson, I want to thank, I don't know the speaker's name, but the presenter's name, but I want to say thank you. However, I wish to maybe raise a concern around the specific professions and professionals that we need to be able or that should deliver on the Domestic Violence Act. And I even think that we can take this forward as a debate. My own belief is that policemen, and I will, because we're talking about policemen, I think there's a lot of confusion at this point in time. I'm sure that policemen very often don't know what their role really is. So I would like to know from I would like to ask the presenter, in my view, we do have many professions that have to contribute to domestic violence. However, if we're going to want policemen to be all those characters that you made mention of, it's the same as with teachers. Teachers also don't just teach. They hardly have time to teach our children the academic information that they need to grow. They must be the parents, they must be the psychologists, they must be the doctors at school, and all of that. And I really believe that we need to start looking at the fact that all of these sectors are a component of delivering on the domestic violence, instead of putting too much pressure on police having to do this and that and the other. Then lastly, Chairperson, the reason for me to say this, because it came out in many of the other public hearings, where there's a lot of expectations of the police and even all the other stakeholders, I would want to believe, if all of us, with our skills, pull together our efforts and deliver on the Domestic Violence Act, then we will surely make impact. Instead of bringing a lot of confusion and having social workers and having doctors and having policemen and having teachers doing more than the specific role that they actually went to go study with for. So I would just like to hear how you feel about my input.
Yes, I think that actually I started saying that we expect that our society expects that from police, and we should not actually. What's the kind of a bit of a sarcastic comment in a way? Did you see at the end of the sentence, if this person is all that, he might be a good policeman. That was the policeman was saying 1905 actually, and we still have the same situation. We expect a lot from them. And what I'm saying is, like, we should not, like you say, it's really a role of the whole society to deal with domestic violence. However, we should be clear on what they're supposed to be doing. And at times I think that's a problem. We are not clear on what they are supposed to be doing, and they don't know exactly what they're supposed to be doing. And I'm going then back to the questions around the mediation. I think mediation counseling is a very, very particular skill. You cannot just do it without proper training, and I think that's a problem. I think we have found that sometimes police, just to avoid kind of opening cases or you know, like because they have read a situation in a particular way, they think that there is not really kind of a proper case that they would turn to mediate and counsel, and that's wrong. What they're supposed to do is to inform the victim of their rights and also like explain to her or him. We know it's actually a gender-neutral act. Explain to the person what is the situation, assess the risk, for instance, but not enter into mediation. If you see the case set put at the beginning, this person had a protection order, and she explained to them what was happening, but they insisted in kind of mediating in a way. So in that case, I could say they're not playing their role. So I think you cannot expect police to mediate, or you shouldn't actually ask them to mediate or counsel if they're not really properly prepared. That goes back also to the training skills they have. What are they trained in? We don't know exactly, and I think they really don't know their role yet in terms of applying their act to mediating.
Are you then recommending that mediation, as you're saying, it's a skill?
I think
that it can be part of the skills that can be provided to the police.
I think I wouldn't be so bold to advise that, because I think it's a very, very, I think we need to talk about it in terms of, like, how can they be more creative on how to deal with situations. But mediation, I think, is a very, I wouldn't put it in the hands of police, actually. I think, again, we will be loading them with more and more instead of, like you are saying, why don't we have more personal psychology, social workers working on this instead of, again, loading the police with more and more.
But these are very emotional and complex cases. And in some instances, you know, you need to apply your humanitarian... sometimes it's a very emotional thing. So you cannot just act, pretend as if you cannot, there's nothing that you can do. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you can even try to avoid a situation or people going to court and all that, you know. Mm-hmm. But I'm saying, you know,
I think we need to explore more like creative ways in which police can act beyond just the punitive, you know, aspect. But we have to be very careful on giving them too much roles in terms of mediating against counsel, which is a more long-term intervention too. When we are talking about assessing the situation, it's a risk assessment. You know, that's one possibility.
Yeah. No, the point that I just wanted to make is that police, they are also human beings. They also have feelings.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
You know, I think what also should be very clear, is that police and the victim, the police should be very clear that in our mind, even to ordinary people like us, in our simple mind is that once you get to a police, you know, a police station, there should be some sort of changes immediately.
Yes.
You see? That is why even when you see two people, say at home and you just see two people in the street fighting, the first thing you do is say, call the police. That's the amount of trust and hope we have in you people. So we expect, you know, the same response from you. That's all we are asking.
That's right.
You understand
that's
what I mean?
Mm.
That's what it's about.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chairperson. So, call to my name. I think you have said a mouthful here about the expectation of the public for the police. And we have so many police stations here, let's say in South Africa, because there's a general complaint that people don't get what they want when they go to police stations. Mine is just a comment to I'm happy that the police are represented here. They heard from yesterday, today, and even tomorrow, even next year, there'll still be a complaint. But I'm putting it forward to our committee that we can't solve this big problem, but we can minimize it by trying. Can't we have a sort of, here in the Western Cape, an oversight to this police station? Because the police officials will come to the meeting, portfolio committees. They are going to give us what they are doing, and they are going to give us what we want to hear. But I would say, can't the police please be capable of trying to help the public, so that it seems 10 women out of 12 are saying the same thing. So my proposal is, I think now it lies in the hands of the committee to go for an oversight to hear exactly what is happening to this general complaint about the police, or invite the police station head to the committee, because they are the one who are doing the spade work in trying to please the public, which says they are not getting help. Thank you.
What needs to be clarified is that after this exercise, the committee will chat amongst itself, you know, on the presentations that were forwarded to us, and then we'll come up with the report, recommendations, and so forth. Honorable Malchus, Honorable Kekani, and Honorable Dorothy, Honorable Priscilla.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm finding the whole hearing very interesting. And you are correct, you say the police officers. But I think when we, like you, proposing already what we should do, the whole approach when it comes to this act is intersectoral. There are other departments involved too. And I think that we have to get right. Because, you know, if you look at the ground there, for example, you go to the Victim Empowerment Center at one of the police stations in Port Elizabeth. Then they don't know. Then they'll tell you, then you ask, who's in charge of the center? And they say, no, it's social development. And the thing is, people don't know who is the lead department in what. And I think that is going to be important, because we have the police in. I think the deputy commissioner. and I spoke to us on sexual violence and the Domestic Violence Act and what they are doing. And what will be important is to get all the departments in together under one roof. The police, justice, social development, health, just have everyone here, and we will discuss this hearing fully. Thank you.
And for instance, the very first presenter spoke about shelters. So it then calls social development to liaise with those people and hear what their needs are. The second presenter spoke about programs. It's then again here we need the Department of Education to be pulled in as well. So you are correct to say it's a lot of departments. And I do hope that the departments that are here do pick up these issues and ideas. Then they can put them, you know, put them on a try and see whether it works or not.
So I get surprised when we get presentation that talks about the police and the police and its relationship with the society. And we never come to hear about the community policing forum. I mean, they were established precisely to ensure that communities' expectations are achieved within the police station. They were there to implement the ideals of the community and make sure that if you're complaining about the police, because you can't complain to another policeman, you should go through the community policing forum to make sure the police do their work or even support the police in doing their work. Now, why don't we get the report of how that structure is faring? Because indeed we accept the police is not going to do all this, but at least there has been some support structures within the police station established. At least we'd like to hear feedback that says, now they are failing decimally, or they are just there in offices, we don't know what they are doing. I would like the lady to comment on that. And actually, I must say, I love your accent. If you could talk to me the whole thing.
Yes, I can do that. If I can convince you something.
Come on, I'm not sure about what you said. I'll correct my youth.
Shall I answer now? I think on that, yeah, you're right. We really talk very little about the role of the community policing forums. Like, in general, I think one problem is maybe some communities are not really interested in taking part in these forums. In some areas, they are very active, in other ones, they are not. And I think also there has been a kind of politicization of the community policing forums that might general also be beyond the domestic violence issue or gender-based violence. I think there have been serious issues of use by certain communities. Like if you think of the xenophobic attacks last year, there have been accusations that certain policing forums were kind of used for certain purposes. So it's just my general observation. I think we haven't made proper use of the forums, you're right. I couldn't tell you more about that, but I know they're not very effective in terms of gender-based violence.
Any more questions?
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm just wanting to support your idea that, you know, after all this, we will sit down and discuss, because I think also what I picked up from the presenter is that, you know, policemen are there to police. You know, and every other matters have to be dealt with by respective, you know, expertise, I mean, people with skills and the know-how. For instance, you know, if we can make an example about, you know, the hospitals. whereby they were managed by, you know, doctors or matrons, and it was quite clear that, you know, that was not working. Because I think policemen are there to police, you know, and a health person is there to do that, you know, a medication. A teacher is there to teach and not to manage. So I think you are right that we have to sit down with all the other departments, you know, because this is a class-cutting issue with all other departments involved. So I would like to support that idea. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think I can say I am covered by the previous speakers to say if you listen to the presentation, there are so many departments that are involved in this. And as two committees, after compiling the report, we will call all the relevant departments. And also, it is clear if you listen that these acts need amendments. And so we should actually sit, and the presenters must also assist to say, where are we going to, should we amend, so that when we start dealing with this act, then we know exactly, you know. And also a research, you know, to say, We must also raise the successes of this act that has been put in place, because definitely they are there, but there is some lacking in some sort. To say we must correct this, because if we get that, even in police stations, if we do a research of whether all the police stations have got the units. When you get to the police station as a woman, definitely you must be directed to a place where you will be free to say your complaint. So we must make a research, and also as members of parliament in our different constituencies, we must make sure that we gather that information so that we work together to see whether we can make changes. Thanks.
But also, amongst ourselves as government or parliament, we need to try and say it loud and clear that as members of parliament, you don't have strong teeth to bite. That is a fact. That's why as you are driving down Adderley Street, well, it's not so much in Cape Town, but in other provinces, you see a police vehicle doing what it's not supposed to do. We see these things. But what do we do as members? You just look, and we are not empowered with enough teeth to bite. We see these things happening. You know, police vehicles parked at the wrong places, at shebeens, and then when a victim complains and is in need of that vehicle, you are told they are not adequate. I think also on our part, we need to have more teeth to bite. I don't know how we could do it, but our teeth are a bit blunt when it comes to that. And also, as Priscilla is saying, that we would need a civil society to pick up on the issues that need to be amended. For instance, the Act is very quiet on the specific role that should be played by the Department of Health, and yet the Department of Health is vital in this legislation. That is where the victim finally ends, but nothing obliges the doctor to or the health practitioner to make a report or something. Nothing in the Act talks about such things. So I think definitely the Act does need to be amended. But can I say thank you for now? Thank you very much, and thank you for the work that you are doing. I appreciate it a lot.
Can I again check on whether I leave the princess here? Not yet. Can we then go to Project Abroad, Human Rights Office? Are they here? Are you here?
Yeah.
Where are you? If we could move fast on that, it takes us, you know, a few minutes, and I think we are in need of those minutes. And can you check whether the next presenter is yes? Mosaic. Okay. You may begin.
Good morning, Chairperson, honorable members, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Amanda Tree, and I'll be presenting on behalf of PARO, the Project Abroad Human Rights Office. It is clear that domestic violence is an important and prevalent issue in our society today, for if it weren't, we would not be here discussing the implementation of the Domestic Violence Act. Yet many of the challenges in the implementation of the DVA have been prevalent since its inception, and still 10 years later have not been effectively addressed. Part of our mandate is to educate people on their rights. In the context of domestic violence, we did this by organizing a panel discussion for the Lavender Hill community. Through this panel and our cases involving domestic violence, we have had first-hand experience in the obstacles to the effective implementation of the DVA. These obstacles include inconsistency of action by SAPS. We have had cases whereby there were lengthy delays between when a complaint of domestic abuse is made and appropriate responsive action by police. Furthermore, many of our cases have had no arrests of perpetrators being made, even though there was clear evidence of potential harm. For example, at our panel discussion, one lady from the Lavender Hill community claimed that in August her daughter was abused by a family member who first threw a brick at her and then threatened her with a gun. Because she lives on one side and he lives on the other side of police jurisdictional boundary areas, nothing has been done. Each police force said it was out of their area and refused to act, despite the fact that the man had an unlicensed firearm. It took until October to even get a court date, and then the man did not show up to court. To date, the perpetrator still walks free, and the firearm has not been confiscated. There is also inconsistency in the granting of protection orders. There is an apparent inconsistency amongst magistrates in determining when a complainant qualifies for a PO. Many of our cases see women not being able to obtain a protection order because they have not got enough evidence to show cause. This is a two-pronged problem. On the one hand, many victims do not know what evidence they can provide to show cause for protection, and on the other, there is still a lack of knowledge and training of magistrates and clerks on the implementation of the DVA. Also, the wording of the Act itself is unclear in regards to the execution of a warrant of arrest. Section 8.4c implies that it is up to the discretion of the police whether there is enough evidence to execute the warrant for arrest. Lastly, there's a lack of coherence and communication between the various governmental departments and service providers that ultimately hampers the victim's ability to access various services, such as counseling, finding shelter, information that may aid them in applying for a protection order, and general protection from reoccurring acts of domestic violence. Therefore, in light of these obstacles, PARO would like to suggest some recommendations that address these issues for the consideration of the committee and other relevant government bodies. That training programs be revised and regularly updated for service providers. This is especially imperative for police and magistrate clerks who regularly come into contact with victims and perpetrators of domestic violence. Furthermore, that the training courses be made mandatory for employees of service providers, and that employees must attend training on a regular basis instead of a once-off training session. that a less intimidating platform be introduced and implemented for members of the community to file complaints against the inaction of or delayed action of SAPS when responding to complaints of domestic violence. Furthermore, that monitoring processes be introduced to monitor response times and actions of SAPS during incidences of domestic violence, and upon the incidents that SAPS does not perform, to recommend appropriate disciplinary action. Section 8 of the DBA is amended to reduce confusion when a warrant for arrest needs to be executed. The specific subsection in question 4C contradicts the aim of a warrant for arrest, further implying through the words if and opinion that it is at the executor's discretion whether they execute the warrant for arrest. We understand that there are guidelines in the implementation of the DBA for magistrates. These guidelines are aimed at assisting and guiding magistrates in implementing the DBA to ensure legal consistency and legal uniformity. Although on paper the guidelines may fill a gap in training of magistrates, in reality this is not the case. Hence, research should be conducted to determine whether further training in the DBA is needed for magistrates, especially for magistrates that handle a lot of the domestic violence cases. Alternatively, magistrates who are experienced in dealing with domestic violence cases or who have been adequately trained in the DBA should be the only magistrates who preside over domestic violence cases. Lastly, there needs to be one organization or committee appointed to collate information on all the various service providers and the services rendered for victims of domestic violence. Furthermore, that this organization or committee communicates and coordinates with the service providers and provides an outlet for service providers to meet. This helps to identify and minimize gaps in the types of services and support provided for victims of domestic violence. We hope that the committee will seriously consider the obstacles that reduce the effectiveness of the DBA in its implementation. Moreover, that the committee will deliberate upon the recommendations suggested during the review process and implement appropriate strategies that address the various challenges and obstacles. Everyone has the right to safety and security, and no one, especially women, children, and people with disabilities, should ever be subjected to acts of domestic abuse and violence. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you very much. Honorable Kekan, what do you think about the accent? It's another nice one. Okay. Thank you very much. You spoke about protection orders, the inconsistency. I think the courts, again, and you spoke about evidence. I've noted that they require a lot of evidence. Sometimes perpetrators don't have, I mean, victims don't have people who can, I mean, evidence to for them to be awarded protection orders and warrant of arrest as well. And you spoke about the ongoing training for magistrates and the police and the response time. I've noted those ones. Members? Comments, questions? Honorable Masha Maite?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. The presenter here refers to a training program which must be revised regularly training of employees of service providers. I just want to get it clear as to which service providers are you referring to? Are you referring to non-governmental organizations? Or which service providers are you referring to?
I guess in that sense, any service provider, anyone that is rendering a service to these to victims and perpetrators. But especially you'll find, like, with SAPs and clerks who come, you know, into contact with victims of domestic violence, they're often the first port of call, so they training is essential for them, or should be essential for them.
But you are talking about things providers not knowing the number of those service providers. because we are talking at national level as we're speaking now. And we talk of a country. And maybe you can also share with us as to who should run this training, government, whoever.
I think that's something for the government to deliberate upon, whether they want to be the ones to take control and to provide the training, or whether they appoint an organization to facilitate the training.
Honorable Priscilla Temba.
Chairperson, thank you. And let me thank the presenter for the the presentation being so clear. Also in the amendments that need to be looked at. And also this continuous training, actually it was even raised in the previous a presentation to say we must also look in the Department of Justice the amendments that should be done when like dealing with bail issues, because sometimes we look at a person being arrested today and after 2 hours see the person on the street, then we forget to say there is a law that is guiding the bail, and we should actually look at the Department of Justice changing, amending, so that if a person is arrested we mustn't see him or her on the street. The law must take its course. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I want to ask the Amanda. I want to ask, besides the recommendation of Section 8 to be amended, is there anything else that is positive out of the Domestic Violence Act that you feel you can say to us as a committee that is an area where you really don't have to change anything? Because I have to, you know, now turn around and maybe give other organizations an opportunity to think about it, because all that we're getting is, you know, the negatives and those that we need to set right, which is not a problem, which we will at the end do. But it is also, it would also be good for us to hear how organizations and projects such as yours and being abroad, how you feel about some of the other sections of the Domestic Violence Act, and maybe just give us, if you don't have it now, maybe think of looking at it, and afterwards maybe you can send through your recommendations, because I really believe that would also help us to have a broader view of organizations, how they feel about sections that is actually working well. Thank you very much.
Honorable Hope, Honorable Mokoro, Honorable Priscilla.
Thanks, Honorable Chairperson. What I'd like to say to the Chairperson and to our coordinators, that I went through the presentation already now, and I didn't actually listen, that we shouldn't lose the point when it comes to the guidelines for the implementation of the Domestic Violence Act for magistrates, which is aimed at assisting and guiding them in implementing, you know, to ensure consistency and legal uniformity. And I think it will be important that we look at these guidelines and also see if there are any shortcomings. I just don't want the point to be lost. That's why I'm bringing it up. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. First of all, I've got to apologize for coming late. I've been busy with the issues pertaining to the plenary of this afternoon. Thank you. The report, Chair, speaks about further training for the magistrates and training for the police. One would suggest that if the presenter could probably, in this instance, suggest what type of training does he have in mind insofar as magistrates are concerned and the police are concerned, because one would say, the police would say, we are trained as policemen. And then the magistrate would say, no, I'm a lawyer, so I qualify to be a, but specific, maybe something that he's got in mind, which could probably help, you know, the recommendation coming from this session to say, let us amend here or let us improve here. Yeah, maybe if he's got, he can just say, maybe make us know about it. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you, Chairperson. There's only one thing that I forgot to raise, the abuse by a family member. I think we need to have education on our civil society, because definitely that is a problem. I go and report today that my husband has abused, or the uncle has abused my child. Then after the family has got together, then we go and, you know, cancel the case. So as service providers, let us work together and educate our civil society on this matter. Thank you.
Just in terms of further training, I don't have any modules in mind, but I feel maybe more research can be done in that sense to recommend training. I do know that the police only ever go through like just a once-off training session, and I feel that that may not be enough, and it comes across even that that is not enough. In terms of, you know, being sensitive to the experience that the victim has undergone, and in handling that, and in interacting in an appropriate manner with the victims and the perpetrators, I think that is something that training should incorporate, basically. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Alida Prince, are you here? Honorable Mukhoro, your hand is up.
My hand is up. I wonder, we are speaking about abuse of women, abuse of children, and we are getting presentations after presentations. But when I'm sitting and thinking, are we really dealing with the matter from the level in which we should? I think we should actually be dealing with the causes of abuse. If we can go down to that level, maybe we can emerge as a forum with something tangible that, because insofar as I am concerned, if you go to the police, you're going to report something that has happened. And the police will come and arrest the perpetrator. And in court, the magistrate would like you to put on the, you know, on the table tangible evidence that can convict the perpetrator. We are actually glossing over the point, but I would suggest that have we ever, because this committee is a new committee, have we ever gone down to the level of trying to see what are the causes of society to be so abusive? And maybe from there we can get a better thinking, better perspective. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mukhoro. We are on a monitoring and evaluation process. Just to maybe highlight what is the aim
of the public hearings. The main aim of the public hearings is to find out the impact of the domestic violence. If you could remember that it has been in place since 1998, ne? So it's 11 years. We want to check the impact of the Domestic Violence Act, whether it has been on persons affected by domestic violence and abuse, and also to gain insight into both challenges and achievements of the Act. Hence, we are getting people from different NGOs, from individuals presenting, highlighting where we should improve as government, which parts of the Act should be amended. I Auntie Hope, I'm correct, ne? This is the purpose of this meeting. I also want to reiterate what the chairperson said earlier on, to say that once these 2 days public hearings are completed, the committee will deliberate on the submissions and draft a report and strategic framework to take forward the issues highlighted during the public hearings. The framework will identify short, medium, and long-term solutions and actions required by Parliament and the Executive in relation to the Domestic Violence Act. So we are here to listen, to ask questions, like the question that you've asked earlier on. I think it was relevant, because what we are doing here, we're just monitoring, we are evaluating whether this act, is it really helping, you know, people who are implementing the act, are they acting within the framework of the law? So basically, this is what we are doing. So after these 2 days, then as members, we're going to collect the notes, and then we're going to deliberate, I think, for 2 days as well. Then we'll come up with recommendations if we amend certain sections of the act or not. Ma'am, your hand was up.
Thank you, Chair. But I think you've covered me, because I also wanted to respond to what the member was raising, because I think it is an important question that he raised. But I think you have responded to it adequately, because I think we cannot do it alone as committee, as government. Hence, we have invited, you know, civil society, NGOs, so that we can come and share. And also that we are looking at implementing this, I mean, at whether the act, the current act, is, you know, has got impact. And out of all these discussions, we will then be able, like you said, to sit and say, where are we not doing right and where we are doing right, and improve. But hence, we'll eventually amend the act.
Thank you, Chair. Now, you covered me with everything I wanted to say. Thanks.
Yeah, just likely also to bring up the issue of public participation. As parliamentarians, we are lawmakers. We don't implement the law. And we also expect feedback from the people So this is actually a process of trying to engage with the people. I hope members are clarified now. In terms of the program, we're supposed to break for tea. I think we'll break for 15 minutes, unless if is it Alida Prince is here. If she's not here, then... Are you here? Okay. If Alida Prince is not here, I'm going to request that we break for 15 minutes. Tea is served outside. Thank you.
Yeah. And I'm upping up, for example, that I don't have time, because
we can follow up.
Hello.
How are you?
Well,
that's
my name,
yes.
Yes,
I hope your presentation goes well. Thank you.
Can we have Mosaic to present for us? And while they're still speaking, is Mosaic here? Hello? Is Mosaic? Oh, is it a rumor? Mosaic? Can I just make this announcement that immediately after the presentation of Mosaic,
yes,
I'm going to request that all members who are not members of parliament should please leave the room. We're going to get presentations from children. So it's going to be a committee. We're going to be on committee, né, with children. And before we do that, I want to hand over to a member from Limpopo. I apologize. She wanted to raise an issue before Mosaic present.
Yeah. Chairperson, thank you very much. I was just wondering as to what the observations of civil society and service providers, those organizations that have presented here, their observation with regard to the service of police, whether both sexes, that is men and women, their level of sensitivity to domestic violence issues, what their observations are, so that going forward as legislators, then in our recommendations, whether we should recommend the training of more of this sex for this and this and that offices or services, etc. Because I think some of the presentations here were quite eye-opening. But I'm just wondering whether the sensitivity of men and women in SAPS, whether it's the same. Thank you.
Police, are you here? You want to respond?
Thank you, Chief. I was busy talking to one of the previous presenters to get some more information from that presenter. Can I?
Okay, I'll ask her to repeat the question.
Thank you.
Chairperson, thank you. I'm saying, is the sensitivity of men or male and female SAPS officers the same when it comes to cases about this domestic violence? Are they equally sensitive, or do we have different sensitivities depending on whether this person is a man or is a woman? And I said, this information is going to be very, very helpful to us as legislators, the members on this committee, so that when we recommend for training of more officers, maybe based on the answer we will get, maybe our recommendation should be biased either towards men or towards women. Level of sensitivity. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I think that's a very important and a very valid question. The fact of the matter is that policemen and women in South Africa come from the society in South Africa. They represent society. And therefore, They are no different from normal human beings as far as their sensitivity is concerned. We pay specific attention in our training to raise the levels of sensitivity of all our police men and women. But we must remember that we are living in a patriarchal society, whether we like it or not. That is a fact. And therefore we find that male persons find it more difficult to make the switch and to actually come to grips and make that paradigm shift in their heads, to come to grips with the situation as it should be, and not the situation as they were brought up in this country. So therefore, yes, indeed, it is more difficult for males, it is less difficult for women, because women in the police also experience from time to time, they come from homes, in some instances, where domestic violence was committed. They are sometimes themselves subject to domestic violence, whether their husbands are in the police service or outside of the police service. So therefore they have a better experience and a better understanding of the plight of especially women in the situation. However, I can also assure you that we also have a problem as far as women in South Africa is concerned, and therefore also women in the South African police service, in the sense that there are many women who still believe that the husband is the boss and should be listened to, and that that is the approach that they still follow. So sensitivity training we present not only to male police officers but to female police officers in exactly the same fashion. So we also believe that there is a real need for those police officers to make the paradigm shift. However, that paradigm shift should actually be made in society itself, and society should change its attitude. And therefore, one of the previous presenters spoke specifically about the difficulty of making sure that this happens at a very early childhood, so that we have a new generation growing up having made the paradigm shift, having moved into the direction of a better understanding of the complexities and the social complexities surrounding domestic violence. But that is part of our training, and in fact it is the focus point of our training in the initial stages. Thereafter we move on to the practical implementation of the legislation.
Thank you very much. Over to you, ma'am.
Honourable Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to present. My name is Marita DeForce. I'm the Director of Mosaic Training Service and Healing Center for Women. We're based here in Cape Town. We have many programs focusing on domestic violence, but I'm going to talk about our experiences in the court. We have a team of 25 workers delivering services at the domestic violence court, 16 of them here in and around Cape Town. I think I want to start by saying that Mosaic's statistics in the courts confirm domestic violence's negative impact on women's physical, mental, and sexual health. We offer services, about over 20,000 people here in Cape Town in 1 year go through our hands in 16 domestic violence courts. And the figures are staggering. And if you look at the statistics, you know, of the abuse itself, you will see very worrying issues. Just a picture there of our figures of last year, it reveals me that domestic violence is often very noisy with accusations, criticizing, name-calling, and much psychological manipulation. 94% of the figures over 20,000 people that we helped mentioned psychological abuse and manipulation in their application orders for protection orders. through threats and abusive behavioral problems such as substance abuse. Economic abuse was mentioned in 58% of the cases. That poses a serious threat to women and their children's survival and health. And alarmingly high, of course, is physical abuse, 63% of the cases. And lastly, sexual abuse, which was 13%, and which included forced sex and often forced sex in front of the children at home. If you look at the Population Council, they made a very handy categorization of health consequences of domestic violence and abuse against women and children. And they divided between non-fatal and fatal outcomes. Of course, the fatal outcomes is a femicide, suicide, age-related mortality, and maternal mortality. And then if you look at the non-fatal outcomes, there's a whole lot of fatal outcomes that's costing the country millions and millions of rands in terms of physical injuries and chronic conditions, sexual and reproductive health problems, psychological and behavioral outcomes. I'm not going to go through all of them, but we see them all in the domestic violence court. If we want to look at the health obligations of the Domestic Violence Act, it doesn't say very much. It says that SAPS has to arrest the victim if the victim may suffer imminent harm risking his or her health. SAPS has to take the survivor for medical treatment if it's necessary. They say that a health service provider can also apply for a protection order on behalf of a victim. I don't know if that ever happened yet. The court may impose additional conditions to provide for the health of the victim, such as seizing a weapon and so on. But there are very many health issues with regard to the Domestic Violence Act. We say the obligation of the state to prevent, investigate, and punish violence against women also includes the fulfillment of health rights. And the Domestic Violence Act does not provide for psychosocial support. It doesn't specify the role of the Department of Health. There's no policy framework attached to the Domestic Violence Act that links it to the Victim Empowerment Program and the role of the health sector and other policies. And then if you look at the health policies, they're fragmented in terms of domestic violence. You get the primary health care package. There's a lot of insufficient screening for domestic violence in the clinics and the hospitals. There's many problems at the emergency units. There's infrequent referrals from the clinics to other service providers. We did some research, and I must say that these hearings are just too early for more results that we want to publish about research that we did with the Gender Health and Justice Research Unit at UCT on attrition rates at these courts that we work at. And we looked at the women who don't return for the finalization of their orders, and many mentioned reasons which were related to the physical and mental health of victims and or their children. You know, there's almost 50% of cases where the women that don't go back to court to finalize those orders. Now, why not? And we found that 18% were threatened with death by their abusive partners, or the abusers, if they return to court, and that threats of further violence occurred in 21% of the cases, and that the abuse actually got worse in 10% of the cases. And in 7% of the cases, the abuser threatened to burn down the applicant's house. In 10% of the cases, the applicants were threatened with some form of sexual assault, and 40% of victims reported the abuse of alcohol or drugs by the abuser. Then if you look at the mental health issues, there's a shortage of psychologists. We think that the basic lay counselor skills is limited to deal with depression and anxiety attacks and so on of victims. Very often, a woman would only visit an NGO, an abused woman, an NGO once or twice. So the real individual psychosocial support is lacking. They don't have chance to go more often. The mental health needs of the affected children in those households are just completely lacking. But we found that in other research that we did, we found that if you do some counseling without a woman having gone the court route,
if you did some counseling, it had the same effect as a protection order. So we have to look much more at that. And then, of course, the shortage of shelters where women and children can have time to recover from their health consequences. If you look at the research that we did in 2006, and you look at the mental health issues, of the cases, 77% of the women had anger issues, 69% fear of the abuser, 35% loss of confidence, loss of concentration, depression, 62%. Tension and anxiety, 69%, and excessive crying, 41%. Sexual and reproductive health issues are also not getting enough attention. We say that abused women need special counseling on the link between violence and sexual and reproductive health, especially in terms of the treatment of sexually transmitted infections and VCT and cervical health and pap smears and pregnancy-related problems, because very often when pregnancy is there, the abuse gets worse. Of course, in terms of nutrition. And I think our UNGAS report of the country that needs to go to the UN next year in terms of our HIV/AIDS progress in the country, we have to make this link between domestic violence and HIV. The model that we are using in our organization, which says that you have to tackle domestic violence on more than one level. You have to look at on the root causes and the consequences, on the individual, the relationship level, the community level, societal level. And in the very same manner, we say that legislation and policy must deal with the problem on various issues. We have legislation, we've got a good act, but the policy surrounding it should look at all the other causes and consequences and be integrated. The health policy, we say, there should be a health policy on domestic violence, a comprehensive health policy on domestic violence in the Department of Health. And I think there should be a national policy framework for the Domestic Violence Act, linking all of the other policies that are there at the moment, you know, that has to do with domestic violence, linking it. I think the victim empowerment policy is trying to do that. But the DVA doesn't say too much in terms of policy. Then the training of all levels of health workers on domestic violence. There is a profile of an abused woman, screening, how to screen for that and how to refer. I think the domestic violence clients should also be able to access services at the Tutuzela centers for victims of rape. We have to provide more for mental health care through subsidizing of NGOs. We get help from the Department of Social Development, but we get no funding from the Department of Justice. And we are assisting more than 20,000 people going through the courts for domestic violence in one city alone in a year. Addressing the intersection between domestic violence and sexual health. You know, research has shown that there is a high correlation between physical and sexual violence and HIV, more so than between rape and HIV. And if a woman goes to the court and she reports sexual and physical violence, the red light must be flashing, because this is the driver of the disease. And we have to have much better indicators about domestic violence at all levels. If you look at the Justice Department's submissions to the portfolio committees, we see how many protection orders were applied for, but we see nothing else. We have to analyze those figures and see what, you know, who were the perpetrators, where did it happen, where are the hotspots, what are the different patterns of abuse. We have to really have much better indicators and reporting on domestic violence. And then, of course, funding for the organizations who deliver services at the court. That's all. My last point is, Wendy previously, she spoke about specialized domestic violence courts. I think if the Justice Department is moving away from specialized courts for sexual offenses, I don't think they would ever look at specialized courts for domestic violence. But we have to do something about
the cases at the courts because the magistrates are looking at the applications during their lunch times and their tea times and, you know, in between their other work. And it's not good enough. We have to give more attention to the application. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The backlog of cases we spoke about yesterday, and the court tried to respond on that. I would not want them to speak again. I think they gave us a view of what is happening within the court and the challenges that they are facing within the court. I've noted that you strongly spoke about social support and the role that health should also play. Members, do you have comments, questions? Whip?
Thank you, Chair, and let me thank the presenter. I think, Chair, like you're saying that, you know, some of the issues that are being raised were addressed yesterday. But it's quite clear, you know, that what is really coming strong here is the card crossing issues, which we did talk about and that we will be looking into in terms of, you know, working with other departments. Also ensuring that they also take care of what they are supposed to be doing. But one thing that I just want to talk to is about the withdrawal. Because I remember when we were interacting with the police, they were not able to give us the real reasons for the withdrawals. If my memory serves me well, they said that the withdrawal was as a result of the victims wanting to withdraw the cases, but it wasn't, you know, emphasized that most of them were doing that because they were threatened, you know, with death. And I think that's one of the important areas, and I wonder if this 18% really is the actual, you know, number that covers the withdrawals, because it was quite amazing when you got the number of withdrawals during the interaction with them. Yeah, let me pause there because some of the issues I think they were raised earlier. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. I would like to ask you the question. Why do you say that when it comes to counseling, that has the same effect as the protection order? No, perhaps there's something I'm missing somewhere. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks anyway for the presentation again. My question is, does the Mosaic have a plan to deal with issues related to threats and this forced sex? Thank you.
Before you respond, Honorable Kekana, any other member who would want to make a comment? Okay, that will be the last.
Yeah, no, the one where you're saying the root cause should be kind of focused, we agree with that. When you say the root cause at an individual, community, and societal level, the one question I want to ask is about socioeconomic condition. You know, where the father or the husband is unemployed, and as a result, things changes at home because he's been retrenched, and all kind of things start happening. He takes to alcohol, he forces himself sexually, and as a result, the whole list of things that happen that changes family life. Is there some evidence that shows the socioeconomic condition, poverty? I mean, if a woman is resourced, if she's not happy, she can buy a house somewhere else and leave the family. I'm just saying, is the statistics that shows that indeed poverty aggravates domestic violence?
Thank you.
thanks. I think in terms of the counselling, what we saw was that if a woman gets an opportunity to really talk about what's happening at home and how to deal with it and what other options she has to deal with a problem, it does help. She could, you know, there's so many places she could go to. She could get a safety plan for herself. She could go to the court for a protection order. But it seemed to us that the psychological power, personal power that a woman gets through counseling and talking about the issue has the effect that she knows how to deal with it at home. And then the abuse also stops or decreases anyway. How to deal with threats when we do counseling, and threats is one of the issues. The first thing we look at is, if there a firearm in the house, you know, what sort of weapons are there, how to make plans for if there's an incident at home that is going to be very violent, is there an escape plan, things like that. Of course, if it's comes up in the application order immediately, we would want to ask the magistrate to order the removal of any weapons or the removal of the perpetrator from the house. And then in terms of the root causes, many research have shown already that there's a correlation between poverty and domestic violence. Of course, the small homes, the unemployment, all of those things links with domestic violence, not only intimate partner violence, but violence between family members, everybody living under the same roof. But it is not the cause of it. There are many poor households where there are no abuse, and so we must just not say that it's the cause, but it is highly correlated, yes.
Thank you very much. I'm going to request, as I have mentioned earlier on, that from now until 1 o'clock we'll be in committee, and that all members please leave the room except for members of parliament, and then we'll reconvene again after lunch. That we're going to deal with the children, and that the which is it only Molofongolo that is presenting from the church? Yeah. Members of the media as well, if you could please leave the house. And if there are any questions that you'd want to ask in relation to children, you may forward those questions to Mr. Patrick Solomon from Molofongolo. Thank you very much. Let's have a 2 minute break so that we allow members to leave the house, and those who are supposed to present to settle. Members of department, you are welcome to stay as well. Thank you.
Okay, that's no problem.
Can I stop?
Okay, I just want to copy something.
Can we stop? We don't have lots of time. Can we stop?
Can you put it in?
No, members of legislature, you stay. Members of legislature, you stay because you are politicians. I would not want to individually ask people, are you a member of department, are you a member of public? I hope people who are here, all of them, they are rightfully, they're supposed to be here. And also, members should also take note that everything that is going to be discussed in here is confidential. We humbly request that please, no one should publish that in the media. We're just making that special request, please. Let us be sensitive to children's issues. Can you please close the door? Members of the legislature, you're welcome. Please stay. Okay, over to you.
Good morning to committee members. Thank you very much.
To the mic, please.
This mic.
Better?
Sorry about that. Thank you very much for the opportunity again. We've been fortunate once before, so I'm hoping not to push our luck with this committee too much. I will be presenting on some of the issues that our organization has experienced relating to children, specifically in the Domestic Violence Act, and we'll try and keep it short because I respect you've been listening to a lot of people and that there are some young people who are preparing to speak as well. I won't go through those early slides around the outline and what RATCAN does because I have presented that previously, and if you would like to, you can read it. I think what's important for me is just to frame our presentation around what it is that about domestic violence that RATCAN is interested in. Why is it that the Children's Rights Organization is picking up a big...